Hi, I'm Dr. Arjun Srinivasan. I'm the Associate Director for Healthcare-Associated Infection Prevention Programs here at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. And we're here today for this Medscape peer-to-peer discussion on carbapenem-resistant Enterobacteriaceae. I'm joined by my colleague, Dr. Alex Cowan, a medical epidemiologist in the Division of Healthcare Quality Promotion. And Alex, why don't you get us started? There's been a lot in the press lately about carbapenem-resistant Enterobacteriaceae, and in particular, the NDM1 resistance mechanism. Can you say a few words about these new resistance mechanisms that people are hearing so much about?
Sure, be happy to. As most people are probably aware, we've recognized a number of NDM1s in the United States since about April of 2009. So far, that number stands at 5 from 4 different states. All of the cases that we've identified so far have been associated with medical care in either India or Pakistan. Most of these involved inpatient stays, although there was one case that was in a patient who had a chronic medical device and several comorbidities but wasn't actually admitted to the hospital. It's important to point out that none of these cases were associated with medical tourism. We've seen these isolates in a number of different species, including E. coli, enterobacters, and Klebsiella pneumoniae, and these have been identified for both urine and respiratory specimens. Interestingly, we've also recognized another of several other metallo-beta-lactamases besides the NDM1s. So far, we've seen 5 of these in the United States beginning in about November of 2009. 2 of these cases were associated with medical care in other countries, one from Italy and one from Greece, and all of these have been Klebsiella pneumoniae, and most have been from urine, with 1 from blood. It is important to point out, however, that systematic surveillance is not being conducted on these organisms, and these are likely underestimates of the true prevalence of these organisms. Most of these strains that I mentioned have been sensitive to a number of antibiotics, including tigecycline and colistin, but at least one of these isolates was non-susceptible to all known antimicrobials. However, Arjun, as you know, these 10 cases now are really just a drop in the bucket when it comes to CRE in the United States. Can you elaborate?
Yeah, absolutely, Alex. I think that's a good point. And I think a take-home message from this is that there's a lot of attention focused on these new resistance mechanisms, the NDM1 and the VIM and the IMP. But in the United States right now, the Klebsiella pneumonia carbapenemase, or KPC enzyme, is far and away the most common mechanism by which these Enterobacteriaceae bacteria, like E. coli, like Klebsiella, are becoming resistant to carbapenems. And the KPC enzyme, unlike some of these other ones, which are thought to be more common in other countries and imported into the United States, is one that was first identified here in the United States back in 2000. And since that time, they have increased in frequency and become more widespread. For example, we know that in infections reported to CDC and healthcare-associated infections for Klebsiella, 8% of the Klebsiella now reported to us are resistant to carbapenems, and we think that almost all of those are resistant because they've required this KPC enzyme. We've seen reports of the KPC-containing organisms now from 35 different states, so it's spread from North Carolina. Now it's been recovered in 35 different states. And we also have a better understanding of the mortality of these KPC infections. And it's a very serious infection. In one study in New York, which is, I think, some of the most systematic information on these KPC infections, there was about a 40% attributable mortality to these infections. So they're very serious infections. And I think, as you pointed out, there's a variety of different ways that these organisms can become resistant. But ultimately, knowing which enzyme the organism had is really not that important from a clinical standpoint. They all functionally, we think, behave the same way with respect to the need for infection control and the treatment difficulties that they pose. So I think it's most important to take a step back and view the totality of carbapenem-resistant Enterobacteriaceae taken altogether and not worry so much about the specific way by which the organism is resistant. And I think when we think about carbapenem-resistant Enterobacteriaceae, it's important to emphasize a few key points about them. First of all, we've seen that these organisms really have a propensity to spread in healthcare settings, and we've seen that in this country, we've seen that in other countries, and you'll say a few words about that in a couple of minutes, maybe when you talk about some of the outbreak investigations that we've done. The other issue that gives us cause for concern is that the Enterobacteriaceae organisms are ones that can cause both healthcare and community types of infections. And right now, all of our experience with these carbapenem-resistant Enterobacteriaceae are related to healthcare in this country. But we have begun to see some of these infections in outside of hospitals, so in long-term care facilities. And so there is that concern of these community-based pathogens acquiring this resistance mechanism. And the last thing I think that emphasizes the need to try and prevent and control these infections is the fact that they're very difficult to treat. As you mentioned, some of them are truly resistant to all the antibiotics that we have. And we know that there are not going to be new drugs to treat these types of infections that come anytime soon. So let me turn it back over to you. Maybe you can say a few words. You've led a number of these outbreak investigations of these carbapenem-resistant Enterobacteriaceae, and I think the experience from those investigations really helps inform how we can prevent and control these infections. So can you say a few words about the investigations that you've done and what you've learned from them?
Sure. As Arjun says, I think we're lucky here at CDC in that we have the opportunity to work with lots of different hospitals on outbreaks and to learn, I think, learn something every time we do one. I think one of the main things that I've taken away from a lot of these investigations is that it's probably best to intervene on CRE to prevent kind of them from becoming endemic early, when you're just seeing the first few cases, when they're relatively uncommon. When these organisms become endemic, not only does it change potentially the approach to these organisms, I think it also makes it more difficult to control them. I think another important thing that we've seen is how sometimes these organisms are not being recognized as epidemiologically important organisms. And the example I'll give is that, in an investigation that we did where we were asked to come and help control an outbreak that the facility felt had been going on a relatively short period of time. But when we actually looked back at their records, they had had cases for a very long period of time that it just had not gone been recognized. So I think it's important to recognize how important this organism is for the reasons that you mentioned, and also to make sure there's mechanisms in place to be able to identify infection prevention personnel from the laboratory when these are first recognized. In addition, I think we're also seeing the importance of long-term care as a wet reservoir for these infections. Obviously, these infections can be transmitted in long-term or acute healthcare, but we are seeing a lot of these cases kind of being concentrated manifesting themselves in patients in long-term care, especially long-term acute care. So I think it speaks to the importance of approaching this organism across the spectrum of healthcare. It certainly requires aggressive communication between acute and long-term care when these cases are being transferred, et cetera, so that appropriate interventions can take place in both settings. And I think lastly, which is a point that often gets overlooked, I think at least outbreaks of these organisms can be controlled. It's certainly not easy, but it is possible. In addition, I think, like you pointed out, we have learned a lot from this, and I think these lessons help us develop the guidance that we released to help others with these organisms. And Arjun, of course, you were one of the primary authors of the CDC HCPAC guidance for control of these organisms in acute care settings. What should facilities be doing to prevent the spread of these organisms?
Yeah. I think, Alex, when you boil it down to what people need to do, it actually ends up being fairly simple. And the tools that we need people to implement are ones that they already have access to. And I think one of the most important things we've seen, as you were pointing out, is the issue of recognition. It's knowing that these organisms are in your facility and that you need to be taking steps to control them, because we are in a situation in this country where we're early on in this. We hope that we can contain them now. We can act now to control the transmission of carbapenem-resistant Enterobacteriaceae. So there are some facilities where they aren't encountering these organisms, and that's fantastic. And what we want is for people to be aware of the situation. So if you're not seeing it, that's fantastic. But there are some circumstances where people think they haven't seen it, but in fact, those isolates have been seen by the microbiology lab, but have not been communicated to infection control. So one of the things we ask people to do as a first step is to go and talk with your microbiology lab. Go back and look at 6 months or a year of information on your Enterobacteriaceae and look to see if you've ever had any carbapenem-resistant Enterobacteriaceae in your hospital. If you have not, that's fantastic. Make sure that the lab now knows, hey, infection control really wants to know about these organisms. So if you see one, you know, set up a mechanism where the micro lab can alert you right away if you encounter one of these. If you've seen them in the past and you didn't know about them, one of the things that we encourage people to do is to think about going and actively trying to look to see if these organisms are currently present in your facility. And one of the best ways to do that is through what we call a point prevalence survey, where you go and do surveillance cultures on people who were in a unit where the organisms were previously. A lot of these are high-risk units, like intensive care units or transplant areas where there's a lot of antibiotic use. And simply do a point prevalence survey. The studies have shown that rectal cultures are a fairly good way of detecting these organisms. And you can do a point prevalence, and that helps you understand whether or not you're still seeing these organisms or if that one you saw 3 months ago really was the one that you've had in your facility. So if you go back and you don't see any cases, or if you're the type of facility that is not encountering this with great regularity, the other prevention step that we'd like people to take is to think about doing active surveillance cultures when you see cases of carbapenem-resistant Enterobacteriaceae. And essentially what we're encouraging with these guidelines is that if you are in a facility where these organisms are rare, that you treat each case like an outbreak. It's not something that's normally supposed to be there, and so you treat it like an outbreak, like an occurrence that's not supposed to happen. And you do some surveillance cultures on the patients who have epidemiologic links to the case patient that had the carbapenem-resistant Enterobacteriaceae. And the point of those surveillance cultures, of course, is to look for transmission that you didn't know about. It's to look and see if your infection control measures are being effective. And that all fits in the context of recognition, because recognition is obviously a critical step in preventing transmission. Once you can recognize the cases, the steps that you take to prevent transmission are the same steps that everybody already knows about. They're already doing them to prevent transmission of organisms like MRSA and other drug-resistant infections. It's good attention to basic infection control, in particular hand hygiene, and making sure that patients with these resistant organisms are on contact precautions.
Arjun, in addition to things you just mentioned, people are often describe a role for antimicrobial stewardship in the preventing of infections and transmission of these organisms. Do you think that's true, and how should it be applied?
Yeah, absolutely. And ultimately, Alex, I think that's it's a key area. It's an under-addressed area that we need to see a lot more activity in. And the advantage, I think, of it is that improving the use of antibiotics will help address the root cause, if you will, of these carbapenem-resistant infections. You know, the study out of New York showed that exposure to a carbapenem antibiotic increases a patient's risk of getting an infection with a carbapenem-resistant strain of, in that study, Klebsiella, by 15 times. So if we can improve the use of antibiotics, we really have an opportunity to not just address the transmission of these organisms, but to prevent them from developing in the first place. And I think that there are three key steps that people could follow right now that would really improve the use of antibiotics in inpatient settings. And the three steps are, first of all, is to ensure that whenever we write orders for antibiotics in hospitals and other inpatient facilities, that we make sure the orders come with a dose, a duration, and an indication. I think what we've heard from people in the field is that without a duration and an indication, it becomes very hard for other clinicians who are taking care of a patient to stop or change the antibiotics the patient's on, because they don't know why the patient was on antibiotics in the first place and don't know how long they were supposed to be continued for. The second thing I think we can all make sure we're doing is getting the right cultures before we start therapy. And I think that's incredibly important when you're talking about these drug-resistant infections, where the choice of antibiotics can be very difficult and it becomes impossible to guide the therapy if you don't have some susceptibility information to help you do that. The last thing that we really encourage people to do is apply the concept of a timeout in healthcare, which has become fairly common now, to the idea of antibiotic use. And what we'd like people to do is, after about 24 to 48 hours of therapy, is take that antibiotic timeout to reassess your therapy. There's oftentimes information that's come to light in the first day or two of hospitalization that really can inform optimizing the use of the antibiotics. It's a good time to look at the information and, first of all, decide whether or not an antibiotic is even necessary in the first place. Does this patient really have an infection? If they do need an antibiotic, that's a great time to look at the susceptibility results and determine if the therapy could be narrowed in spectrum or altered in some way. And I think that's also a great time to go ahead and make a decision on a diagnosis and put down a duration of therapy so that if you know the patient has, for example, a urinary tract infection, you can specify the right amount of therapy and then go ahead and put that down so that the antibiotics will stop when they're supposed to. I'd like to thank you all for joining us today for this Medscape peer-to-peer discussion on carbapenem-resistant Enterobacteriaceae, and thank my colleague Dr. Alex Cowan for joining us for this discussion. Thanks very much.